This is Dave Boyle, and I'm on the Cinematography Podcast.
The following podcast contains explicit language. You're listening to the Cinematography Podcast presented by Hot Rod Cameras, a program about the art, craft, and philosophy of the moving image and the people who make it happen. Coming to you from the world headquarters of Hot Rod Cameras in Hollywood, California, are your hosts, Ben Rock and Ilya Friedman.
Well, hello, Ilya.
Hello, Ben. How are you?
I'm weathering the spring forward situation a little worse than other years, but you're awesome because can you tell people where you are?
Sure. It's no secret. I'm in Austin, Texas. I'm going to actually put together a little bit of video, or if you follow my social media, I've put together a little stuff already. I'm here for South by Southwest.
So jealous. I've never been to that one.
You know, it might be the best festival on earth if you like this sort of thing. I will say that Austin is a really cool city, as, you know, not a big surprise. It is in some ways weird, similar to Portland, but it's kind of more like Portland's extroverted spiritual cousin. Mm-hmm. It is like a town where there is always stuff going on and people are kind of out. They're very friendly. It is a, I want to say, sort of an oasis in Texas of like liberalism. So, you know, some people in Texas might hate that, but, you know, people who are, you know, from liberal cities come here and it's like, oh, wow, this, you forget you're in Texas for a half second here. But man, it is a place of food and media and music. Yep. And movies, and plus just like education and politics. Like South by Southwest is a mega festival. It goes on for weeks and it is so chock full with video games and quantum computing and you name it. There is something here for everyone. Plus major brands all get here and then they set up these sort of like, they call them now activations, but they, you know, they engage people to in. And yeah, I spent a long time in the Fallout activation. It was something. It was an interesting place. It was an interesting thing. Yeah.
Austin is also home to my personal favorite film festival of all time, Fantastic Fest, which is, I think, maybe not a sister, but like a nephew festival to South By. I think a lot of the same people are involved in it, but it's all genre. It's the most fun. It's at the Alamo Draft House, and it's just the best.
And not to go too off topic here of Austin, but I have met several people who really, really hate how expensive the city has become. And I understand that gas is still really cheap here, but man, I've heard people complain about the rents. You know, Facebook moved in, like Google moved in, Tesla moved in, all these like big West Coast companies have come to Austin and importing some sort of like work culture, not always for the best. There's, you know, Google's in the headlines right now is having a big, you know, labor dispute here, but it's very interesting. I saw Tesla Cybertrucks all over the place. So, you know, Austin is, it's probably a cultural capital of the South, as I've heard people refer to it. So it's interesting.
I believe it. Well, have fun. And I can't wait for the full report on what you saw there and what films we need to look out for and who we're going to talk to, who you met there, all that good stuff.
Sure. I'm looking forward to it. So Ben, on the show today is Dave Boyle. He is the showrunner for the new Netflix series, House of Ninjas. It is a really, really great show. I know you haven't watched it yet, but it's totally your cup of tea. I think you should give it a try.
I definitely will.
It is a subtitled series because it's, you know, it all takes place and was made in Japan. But at the same time, there is several different dubbed options if you're not a subtitle person. Although I think a lot of like hardcore movie people always subtitle people. So,
you know, I know a lot of people who are working in dubs these days. I don't know. I know people who direct the dubs and they take that stuff really, really seriously. And I feel like we all have an idea of dubbed films from, you know, the 1970s, 1980s, whatever, like, you know, bad Godzilla dubs that we might have seen decades past. The people who are doing it now, they take it really seriously. They cast it well. They really direct it. They put a lot of work and care into it. I would rather watch the original performance, but I will admit right here, when I watched El Conde before I talked to Ed Lockman, I wanted to focus on the cinematography and not have my eye going down to the text all the time. So I watched the dubbed version. I don't do that often, and I thought it was amazing. I thought the performances were great. I thought it sounded great. They did a great mix on it. It was not really a downgrade.
Actually, I really wish I had asked Dave Boyle if he directed the English language dub. I actually don't know the answer to that question. One thing I didn't ask him. But the show is super, super popular. It's currently at 100% on Rotten Tomato amongst critics. And it's been blowing up the charts like on Netflix. Tons and tons of people have been watching it for a while. I know it was the number one most streamed series in the world. So
nice.
That's pretty cool. Yeah.
Yeah. And also, before we get into our close focus, I feel like we have to do at least some mention of the Oscars. Quick Oscar roundup.
Yeah.
Well, our Oscar prediction came true, and to no one's surprise, the amazing, legendary, holy crap, what a great guy, Hoyte van Hoytema won Best Cinematography. I loved his speech. I loved how he started his speech by giving a big shout out to shooting on film and how young filmmakers should consider trying this hip new thing called celluloid. I thought it was an awesome ceremony. I also want to do a very, very quick shout out to my friend Alok Mishra. Alok is actually, his daughter plays soccer with my son, but he was a consultant on The War is Over, the Oscar winning animated short.
Mm. Cool. Super, and, super cool.
And he's been regaling me with tales of Sean Lennon. So
very nice. I am actually wearing a Godzilla shirt right now. Godzilla, I think, was kind of a surprise to people. I don't think a lot of people thought that was going to win for best visual effects.
Godzilla minus one. What was it? A $13 million movie? That movie had the catering budget of the movies it was competing against. Or excuse me, it was made for the catering budget of Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3, etc.
It's remarkable because, like, who would have thought a Godzilla movie of all types of movies to actually pull that off, too? Because Godzilla is certainly has a stigma associated with it. Now, there's been other Godzilla movies over time, but they really did a great job, and audiences responded.
It's always interesting to me when, like, a well-worn franchise that we've seen 8 billion times, so like Godzilla's been going on since the 1950s, and there are great Godzilla movies and there are forgettable Godzilla movies. We could bring my friend Graham Skipper on sometime to talk about Godzilla. He wrote a book about Godzilla.
Nice.
He's seen them all, but I feel like, much like I would say Daniel Craig's James Bond incarnation, I feel like Godzilla Minus One takes something that we all thought we knew and injects it with a level of subtext of meaning that surprised everybody. Not, you know, it surprised you, surprised me, surprised everybody, and gave us a movie that was not only a big, thrilling, giant kaiju monster movie, but also a moving human drama that was worthy of being told. So congrats to all the winners, and congrats to anyone who was nominated. On social media, I see people grousing about who got snubbed and who should have won over who blah, blah, blah. And we all do this little horse race thing in our heads. But I just want to remind anyone that anyone who's in that room, including my friend Alok, anyone who's in that room, they're doing okay. You know, like,
they're doing just fine.
If you preferred Lily Gladstone over Emma Stone, believe me, you're going to start seeing more Lily Gladstone around. She's going to get several more bites at that apple. Maybe she'll win next time. And maybe they'll give her a CSI series that'll run for 40 years, or who knows what'll happen. But it's like, you know, just the fact that these people were in this room, it changed a lot of lives.
Yeah. And, you know, actually, I, being in Austin, I was driving around and was not able to get to see the Oscars live. But everyone tells me that Ryan Gosling steals the show.
Much like he did the Barbie movie. Like, I'm not denigrating anyone else in the Barbie movie. I thoroughly enjoyed the Barbie movie. But no one in Barbie seemed to be having nearly as much fun as Ryan Gosling.
He certainly did, and holy crap, is his performance great. It's really, really great.
And now, Close Focus.
Okay, so Ben, we should probably get to our Close Focus. Something kind of happened in the technological side of the industry this past week. Do you want to give our audience the cliff notes?
Well, I will say that this completely blindsided me. I didn't see this coming. I don't know that maybe you did because you're more into the technology side of things, but Nikon purchased, acquired Red camera. That's like a 7-layer burrito of what the fuck for me, because like Nikon, of all the camera, all the camera companies seemed the least competitive in the digital cinema space. They seemed completely uninterested in it. And when you had people like Panasonic and Sony and Canon all kind of vying for that, I mean, it would be like if Sigma had bought Red, you'd be like, what? Polaroid bought Red. You're like, huh?
I disagree. Okay.
Well, you know infinitely more about this than I do, and I will readily admit you're paying way more attention. I just will say that I've been on film sets with Canon cameras, Sony cameras, Blackmagic cameras, and then all the way up to Arri Alexas and whatever the hell. I've never once seen someone pull out a Nikon camera to shoot video. Not once. Not once in my entire life.
All right. Well, this may be a revelation for some people, but I know that Red has quietly been for sale for years. So, so they don't, you know, when a company's for sale, generally you don't have people going out there and shouting about it. There's only a few people who can buy a company of that size, and it makes sense that it be a competitor or someone inside the industry. I really thought it was going to be Kodak. I really thought there was a chance it might be Fuji. I thought either one of those companies, traditional legacy celluloid film companies, who need a real digital strategy for the future, and motion picture usually has been a part of that for everyone who has been in the film game. I thought a film manufacturer was going to be the people to purchase Red. Now, it's interesting because sometimes the company that gets purchased actually ends up swallowing the larger company. I don't know, and I don't think that's going to happen with Nikon per se, but if it had been a company like Kodak, which has been, let's just say, maybe not death's door, but they've been very, very constricted in years past. They, you know, compared to years past, they've really, really slimmed way down and really kind of had to refocus their business and a lot of things. With a company like Kodak, I think that if had they made the acquisition of Red, if they could have figured out how to finance that or make that happen, I would have expected like a Jim Gennard or someone to potentially working their way then up into the upper management or possibly then ending up running a Kodak. Nikon, because it's a very large Japanese electronics manufacturer, I think that that is highly unlikely. But what I do think is very interesting is that Nikon has been making certain overtures to motion picture now for a little while. A few years ago, they tried to get their current products to be accepted by filmmakers. Very famously, they had Janusz Kaminski come and speak about how much he loved their cameras. Granted, I think the community and the market kind of read through all that because frankly, their cameras were not ready for prime time. They weren't ready to do the type of work that I think Nikon had aspirations to do. Now, a few years ago, they purchased Mark Roberts Motion Control. Mark Roberts Motion Control is basically high-end cinema, high-end commercials, that sort of thing. At CES this year, I got to go do a consumer activation where they had like a motion control arm set up and do this whole thing. And I pretended as if I was ghost riding a truck or thing.
Oh,
anyway,
I saw that. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, so Mark Roberts is cinema. And to me, I thought that was an interesting, purchase because that really wasn't inside of Nikon's like core business, but it did give me the insight that I was like, maybe that Nikon is going to become one of these companies that the way that they grow is they acquire other companies, and acquiring companies inside of cinema makes a lot of sense. If they picked up Mark Roberts, they might start picking up other sorts of companies that are either service companies or product companies. And I think Red fits into that really well, especially since they didn't have an obvious strategy going after the high-end cinema market. Now they have one. And I'm not sure what's going to happen branding-wise. I have a feeling they're probably going to leave it alone. I think that probably Mark Roberts, they didn't want to mess around with it and say, well, now it's Nikon Motion Control. I think the Red brand is strong. There is a lot of Red followers out there and people who really like it. I'll tell you possibly the most interesting thing that has happened, though, since this announcement is sort of this mixed bag of vitriol and gloating and memes online of people who have been flying around. And I think it's actually all kind of crazy because I think this is all really good news. I think it's good news to all the people who are involved, including Red and Nikon. I hope them all the best. And I don't think that this is really the type of consolidation that would happen. It's not like Canon swallowing up Panasonic or something like that. And so like a competitor is coming out. Nikon didn't really have a presence in cinema for cameras. And so the fact that the market doesn't really change at all, except for maybe where the dollars are going to be going, inevitably, because ultimately they're all going to get kicked upstairs. And so Nikon will be making the money that Red used to put into their own coffers. So, that's, I'm actually actually pretty optimistic about what this might mean towards the structure of businesses, assuming that they cross all their T's and dot all their I's and that they can make this work. But what might be interesting to me is how the cultures of these companies, which are very, very different, end up coming together. And there probably will be a management change, probably a serious management change, because I think that when you have really, really different cultures, usually it probably won't happen right away, but you'll probably see some high profile exits and some new people come in, and maybe it'll be a new era of Red. Maybe it'll be a new era of Nikon. We'll just have to wait and see.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see too, because like I wonder in the technology world, like I don't know what sensor we're on with Red right now, but I'm sure that they've designed like the next three, like they have them at some level of production. So does Nikon just continue on that glide path? Does Nikon come in and mess with it? I mean, obviously, I think that to me, Nikon, what they're really known for more than their cameras, in my opinion, is their lenses.
Correct.
And so is this going to be a way to optimize the optics for Red to make the glass that goes on those cameras at Nikon standards?
It would not surprise me if we see a return to Red cinema lenses, or more likely Nikon cinema lenses going on to Red cameras, and then a Nikon cinema lens sort of like being born, because the only ones that currently exist are modified ones for cinema. And there are some really nice ones. I know Panavision made a couple of really nice ones for customers over the years, including Oliver Wood, you know, a friend of the show, you know, sadly passed on. But Oliver had some of the coolest Nikon customized Panavision lenses I ever saw. And I expect that because that's right in their wheelhouse, and now with sort of maybe the credibility of cinema that Red is going to be bringing to Nikon in sort of the most recent history, I wouldn't be surprised at all if we start to see Nikon glass making their way onto big sets, especially big sets that are already Red shooting on Red.
Yeah, yeah. The whole story of Red to me is kind of has been a fascinating ride from the origins at where I was, I think, with you at NAB when they showed us the fiberglass resin shell with no camera, but they showed us tests of stuff that had been shot on their first prototype sensor. And I remember standing in the audience when they showed it, and I applauded and looked around, and everyone else was just like filled with rage. And I'm like, I guess
filled with rage.
Yeah, everybody was mad. I think they expected to see a working camera because that. And I sort of knew Ted Shilowitz because I'm from Orlando, Florida, and I somewhere had his DP reel, believe it or not. And he was sort of the face of Red for years and years. And Jim Gennard obviously started it. And then years ago, he stepped down. And I remember you were not a giant fan of Red at the beginning because you were working for Dalsa, who had created a cinema-ready 4K camera. And Red was more hype than camera at that point. But I feel like Red has settled in and has become a very strong player in the space. And I've worked with their cameras. I think they're good. Like anything, it's always about the right tool for the right job. And sometimes that's Red.
You know, one thing's for sure, the market's not boring. If you pay attention, yeah. there's a lot of stuff going on. So anyway, I think, though, that we've spent plenty of time on this. Why don't we get to the interview with showrunner and House of Ninjas creator Dave Boyle?
Here we go.
The Cinematography Podcast Interview.
I'm joined now by Dave Boyle, the showrunner of the hit Netflix series House of Ninjas. Welcome to the Cinematography Podcast, Dave.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. So, I have so much I want to talk about the show itself, but I feel like you are also part of the story of how this all comes together as the show creator and everything else. And you've got an interesting story, and I want to hear a little bit about you and your journey to this before we dive right into the show. And I think we've got enough time. So you've been in this business a long time. You've done a lot of stuff. Can you talk a little bit about the film industry in Japan versus, you know, Netflix in the US? Can you start maybe there, like a little compare and contrast, and how you slot into this whole thing?
Sure. I mean, I can't claim a whole lot of firsthand knowledge up to this point about the film industry in Japan. This was my first time actually doing a show in Japan, even though I'd worked on kind of Japanese language films and did some kind of co-productions with Japanese companies before. But, you know, it definitely is structurally just a different industry in a lot of ways from Hollywood and from the way it works. Just everything from how projects are put together, how the development cycle works, the relationships between all the kind of major studios over there and for example, theater chains and publishing groups and all those things that kind of structurally inform what gets made, how it gets made, all that stuff is a little bit of a learning curve, and I feel like I'm still in the middle of it, to be perfectly honest. Still kind of getting my bearings in a lot of ways. Netflix, in the same way that it has been a disruptor in Hollywood, has been a big disruptor in Japan as well, because, you know, it's challenged the status quo of how things are made and how they're watched and how they're viewed. I don't pretend to have any great insight as to how those decisions are made or anything. It's just sort of as an observer, as one of the people kind of is semi-involved in that, you sort of get the feeling of like, oh, this is definitely different from the status quo. I have a hard time imagining that a Japanese broadcaster would hire me to work on a show like this at a, you know, a budget and scale like this. But for a company like Netflix, you know, it's sort of it kind of makes sense in a way to just try things out. You know, try something different.
Yeah, I got introduced to a little bit of the technical side of the industry in Japan back in 2007 when I was working for a company that was creating the camera and the format known as 4K way back then. And yeah. I was kind of blown away at it, really just how different everything was. And I was curious really from what your perspective was of coming into that and having to navigate. And it clearly you did it successfully because, you know, House of Ninjas, and congratulations on this. I sometimes check the Rotten Tomato meter before I sit down to interview someone. And you're currently at 100%, which is like incredible and insane. It got this popularity. There's not too many shows that I feel can match the tone or does tone so well as to have this sort of really, really broad appeal. And House of Ninjas has it. And I'm thinking of shows like Barry, or maybe going back a few years to like a show like Burn Notice, where it's like it's set in a world, but there is a combination of drama and playfulness, seriousness, as well as comedy, but not overt comedy, not dark comedy in the way of like a Succession or a Better Call Saul. It's a really interesting tightrope to be able to walk a show from beginning to end and maintain this incredible diversity of tone that all kind of fits inside of this worldview of serious and playful. Can you talk a little bit about the tone of House of Ninjas and how, you know, how you guys nailed this so well?
I'm so glad that you're asking about that, because I think tone really was the reason why we all wanted to make this project. It's more than sort of the plot mechanics and the story and everything else. It was sort of all about kind of creating this atmosphere, this tone that an audience could sink into and enjoy for many, many episodes. And so I think that tone was something that we were talking about from the very, very get-go, and something that we really wanted to nail and get right. You know, the way that this whole project got started was actually with the main actor, Kento Kaku, and he had this idea to do a, you know, kind of a revisionist ninja show. He brought that to Netflix. Luckily for me, somebody at Netflix Japan knew me and knew that I spoke Japanese, and that he just felt like this might be something that I could bring something to, and asked me, you know, hey, are you interested in ninja stuff? And I think that, you know, the first thing that I talked about was trying to have a tone where it's both sweet and serious at the same time, where we're not skimping on the thrills at all, but there's, you know, it's sort of a cozy ninja show in a way.
And also that's a great way to describe it.
And also maintaining some ties to real life ninja history. And, you know, we actually know very little about actual historical ninjas, but respecting what we do know and bringing that into the show. And so we talked a lot about how to kind of nail that cozy tone. And it was something that we talked about with all the department heads, and that we were talking about constantly with the writers and everybody else. It's how do we keep this thrilling, but not go so far that we are, you know, breaking the fact that this is a family story. You know, it's a story about a family coming together and all that. And I think that, you know, music turned out to be a way for me to communicate the tone to my collaborators in an effective way. Because when I got to Japan, one of the first decisions that I made was, I speak Japanese as a second language. I'm not a native speaker. But I decided not to have an interpreter for the writer's room or being on set or anything. Like, it was offered to me, but I just really felt like this was a Japanese production and I wanted to make sure that I was a good guest in the Japanese film industry and didn't want to have anybody between me and my collaborators. But then when you get into the real nitty-gritty of talking about this delicate tone that we're trying to nail, you know, that becomes something that's hard to describe even in your native language. So when I gathered the kind of primary cast members of the Tawada family to do rehearsals for the first time, me and the other two directors, we played the Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young song Our House as an example of, this is sort of the tone, the worldview of the show. And everybody was just sat and listened to it in silence. And I saw Yosuke Eguchi, who plays the dad, sort of start to nod his head along with it. And then by the end, everybody kind of understood, like, okay, this is what this family is all about. So, you know, it's funny, but it's also kind of sad and poignant in a way. But it's also, it's like a blood and guts ninja show at the same time. And so getting all those things to meld was, you know, it was a constant process of adjustment from the scripts all the way to the end. And I really felt like the score and the songs were part of tying all that together. I mean, the other thing that we talked about a lot was just that ninjas are creatures of the 16th century. They're people who are sort of out of time and out of place. And so we wanted to capture that in our approach to all of the crafts involved, whether it was production design, you know, the photography, and especially the music. We wanted to maintain a timeless feel to the whole show, even though it you know, takes place in 2024 and we see smartphones and all that other kind of thing. There was sort of a classical, out of time, out of place feel that we wanted to maintain. And I felt like that was going to be something that helped us kind of zero in on that very specific tone that we were aiming at. But there wasn't one other movie or one other show that we could point to and say, like, we're doing that with ninjas or something. You know, it was something that we were kind of feeling our way through the dark with. But that was, you know, that's the fun of this process. That's like, you know, the joy of it is aiming for something that you don't quite, you know, you're aiming for a bullseye in the dark in a lot of ways. And so that was a lot of fun.
It works in a way that if you were just to describe these, you know, discrete items on a piece of paper, you'd be like, what am I going to see? What am I watching? What is this? But so to me, it's like the whole idea of taking it from probably those early days, that early Bible, into what has come to be must have been a real interesting balancing act, and getting your writing and your communication just so that you could get the buy-in from all the other, you know, as they say, stakeholders, all the other people who would be involved in making something like this, because this is not a low budget show. This didn't just, like, you know, materialize with a couple of people running around in a backyard. This has got all of the bells and whistles, and that requires major planning, major details. Can you talk a little bit about the show Bible? Bringing all this together, creating your arc for this 8 episodes, you know, how did that come? I mean, a lot of this, I'm sure, sprung forth from your brain. So talk a little bit about how that happened.
I'd love to talk about the Bible, and I love that you mentioned preparation, because, you know, the prep process in Japan is formalized in a way. It is quite, quite different from anything I'd ever experienced in the U.S. before. So I'd love to talk about that, too. The Bible was, you know, sort of the very first step on this journey. When they asked me if, you know, I wanted to take a crack at, you know, creating the show Bible. And originally that was sort of the one that was going to be it. We just need somebody to kind of crack this story. So I only had 3 weeks to write the show Bible.
What?
And so, yeah, yeah.
So, holy crap. That's like a sprint.
Yeah, yeah. It's you know, you do what you can with the time you're given. And so I quickly did as much of a deep dive as I could into the, you know, the elements of ninja history and the stuff that I wanted to emphasize. You know, I wanted to kind of emphasize elements of ninja-ness that I hadn't really seen before. You know, I really loved the old Shinobi no Mono series from Japan, mm-hmm. from the 1960s. It was sort of the series that started the ninja boom in Japan, and I loved that they showed, like, the lifestyle and how hard it was to be a ninja. And so I sort of wanted to see, like, well, I wanted to think of our characters as like descendants of those folks from the 16th century. But I mean, you know, aside from all like the kind of historical nuggets and that kind of thing, I think the biggest thing that was sort of my way into the story was reading about how many restrictions and rules ninjas lived under, like that they weren't allowed to drink and that they had dietary restrictions and restrictions on marriage and love and that kind of thing. And I really responded to that and felt like folks who are sort of living by this very, very ancient set of rules in the modern day, like what, you know, what sort of conflicts would that create in a family environment? And that, that was sort of the base level of it. And then coming up with sort of the world of the story and the conflicts and all that. And so I did that. And then we did have writers in Japan come aboard the team later on, once the gears had started to grind at Netflix and they decided, let's do this. Because it's as hard as it is in the US to get non-IP stuff off the ground, I'd say it's even harder in Japan. So having, you know, an all original story is, you know, is a very, very, it's tough. And so it took a minute, but then once the gear started turning and we got the cast lined up and everything, then, and that's the other thing, like shows in Japan are typically cast and locked before the scripts are written, just because actors tend to be kind of booked up for a long, long time. And then everybody's, you know, shooting multiple things at once. It's just sort of a different system. So we had to, you know, we had to get that main cast locked in and everything. And then once we hit the ground running and, you know, the team started working on the scripts, then things evolved and we got to the storyline that we have now. But the Bible set out the arc of the story and the key milestones and sort of the worldview of the show and everything. And then we were off to the races. And I think that it was interesting to experience a completely different, I mean, I was working in my second language and also just, I tried to adapt as much as I could to the standards of, you know, Japanese production style. And one of the things that I noticed is that, you know, just the script format of Japanese scripts has a big effect on how the work goes forward, you know, because you know, an American script goes vertically, right? But Japanese scripts go from right to left, and half the page is left blank. The top half of the page is left blank.
Wow.
So, you know, looking at it, when I look at it, it looks to me like an editorial timeline. And then what happens is the director draws in the cut on the top half of the page and a, you know, a description. It's sort of like a shot list, but it's not really a shot list because it's, you know, it's in edit order and this, and, you know, you can look at it like a timeline, you know.
Oh, wow.
in a lot of ways. And then that becomes a way for the director to express to the crew what they're planning to do. And you know, every director is different. Some directors don't do it, but it's hard to get away with unless you're, you know, unless you're a legend. Because just because the focus on preparation in Japan is so, I mean, the prep period is sacrosanct in a lot of ways, especially for film crews. Because unlike the U.S., there's not a whole lot of mixing between film and TV crews. That's starting to change a little bit, but for the most part, they're kind of kept separate. And a lot of, you know, a lot of TV shows are still not shot at 24 frames per second. And
it's a very interesting aesthetic for Japanese television. But that's what people want. And there seems to be a cultural difference between that sort of temporal cadence. And we won't go too far down this rabbit hole, but I remember working on the technology side for many years here, that the goal from some major Japanese camera manufacturers was, how many frames per second can we possibly get to make the smoothest motion, the most soap opera style temporal effect that we possibly can? And that was what was expected for television. Television was an electronic medium. That was the aesthetic. It wasn't the same for cinema. Cinema was, you know, was a photochemical medium, and, you know, there was limitations of that. But I know that it's shifting. It's changing a bit now. Really, you know, it seems like it's taken a very long time, but just out of curiosity, was there any push to try to make it look like a typical Japanese nighttime television drama series comedy?
Yeah, okay. No, there was always, so it was all movie crew, top to bottom.
Okay.
That was hired on it. And so, you know, and so it was also a movie schedule in a lot of ways. We still had to, you know, crank through a lot of pages and a lot of action in a day, but it wasn't anything close to what you deal with on, say, like a typical TBS or NHK sort of drama or something like that, where you really have, you know, just you're just cranking through stuff.
I kind of figured.
Yeah, but it's interesting, you know. I mean, so Yoshiaki Murao, who is one of the, you know, the original ideators with Kento and directed episodes 4 and 5, he's a staff director at TBS Sparkle, one of the biggest broadcast production companies, and so he's very, very familiar with that, and so he is part of, you know, sort of a push to get, you know, a more sort of filmic feel in Japanese broadcast television and everything. And it's interesting hearing from him the, you know, how many meetings there are just to get permission to shoot in 30p instead of, you know, 60i or, you know, like that, wow, that kind of thing. And so it's, you know, it's just very, very, very interesting and different.
I gotta ask you about the title sequence. Like, I will tell you, I'm one of those people, usually when Netflix or a streaming service gives you the option to skip a title sequence, I'm like, I've watched it once and boom, I'm moved on. I did not skip this once. I watched it over and over and over. There was so much going on. I felt like I saw something new every time I got to see it. I looked forward to the title sequence. That's a really difficult thing to do, is to have a title sequence that I feel like informs the story, informs the world, and then also gives you something fun and interesting to look at and moves. It moves really quickly. I never felt like it was, oh, here it is again, the dramatic, you know, score hit, and then another name comes up and, oh, it's a million producers. No. This is a brilliantly put together, wonderful title sequence. As the showrunner, you have your finger in a lot of pies, so to speak. You get to be involved in a lot of stuff, and that, you know, there's other people who that's you know, they have their fiefdom and that's what they do. Can you talk about the title sequence and how much influence you may have had, if any, on the whole thing?
I'm so glad you asked. I love the title sequence. I actually directed the title sequence.
Oh, really? Okay, I had no idea. Yeah, I loved it. It's so good.
I was the creative director for the title sequence. And I wanted to, first of all, do something that felt a little old-fashioned, you know, that sort of got that, you know, I talked earlier about that kind of out of time, slightly late to the party, something out of a different era kind of feel to it. And I wanted to kind of conceptually put in some Easter eggs that hinted at the, you know, some of the historical things that are sort of in the history of these ninja clans that we're depicting. So, you know, it started out as I just wrote a script for it that sort of described each of, you know, what I wanted to see on there. And then, you know, my production designer, Yuji Hayashida, he's got just sort of a wonderful off-kilter design sense. So I worked with a storyboard artist and designer to kind of get the basic idea of what I wanted to see down. And occasionally, I would like draw sort of a real rough storyboard, and then Soma-san, the real storyboard artist, would do like a much better version of that. And we took all that to Hayashida-san, and then he did these wonderful drawings and designs and stuff that then we took to the animation company, and they essentially took his Photoshop layers and did the 2D animation first, and then a compositor sort of put it all together. But it was a very small team, and we had to do it very, very fast. But, you know, what I wanted to express was just the idea that this is an unbroken kind of, basically, we're just continuing a battle that started in 1590. And you know, there's a lot of little Easter eggs for Japanese history buffs and that kind of thing hidden in the title sequence. But for the most part, it's just sort of a tonal thing, you know, getting the sort of mixing and matching the iconography of the show and getting across this fun but sort of off-kilter tone that we're trying to express with the show. So I was really proud of everybody who worked on that and pulled it off. And I didn't realize that that's something that would be within my scope of responsibility, but I was delighted to do it. You know, I love animation and everything else, and being able to have that on screen for the 45 seconds or whatever it is in the show was really, really sort of a joy, and I was glad that we got to do that.
The Americans who I find who spend a lot of time in Japan and bother to learn the language and have a relationship in the country, and it seems like it always kind of comes out of a couple of different things. Either they married into it, they have some sort of family or something like that, or there is a deep-seated love of Japan. There's like this, you know, this appreciation, maybe not for all things, but an appreciation of, you know, the culture as a whole. I'm wondering, where this journey started for you. When did you sort of, you know, I don't know the answer to this question. I don't know if you have some sort of familial connection or if you have a deep-seated love, but it seems to be those one of the two things that I tend to connect with people. Where did this journey, or how did it begin for you? And also, are you a fan of Natto?
I'll answer your second question first. Yes, I am a fan of Natto. I'm a big fan. Oh, nice. Nice.
Yeah. I am as well. It's like as far as Gaijin out there, it seems like it's a brotherhood. There's not a lot of, I don't meet a lot of, you know, Westerners who are like really into Natto, but I love the Natto. Anyway, I'm sorry.
very, very big fan. I like Natto spaghetti and Natto omelets.
Oh, anyway. Yeah, the omelets. That's me too. Yeah.
But where this all began is sort of, it started with a little bit of a coincidence. I come from a Mormon background and Mormon folks, when you turn 19, you know, you're sent off to do missionary work. And I was sent, you know, you don't choose where you go or anything. I was sent to Sydney, Australia on a Japanese speaking mission. So I, you know,
wow.
So I was assigned to learn to speak Japanese. And, you know, I really fell in love with the language and the culture. I was interested in, you know, Japanese movies, and you know, I was interested in all the kind of classic Japanese cinema and all that. But then, you know, it did sort of change the trajectory of my life in a lot of unexpected ways. And from then on, my first couple of movies were sort of very small independent films that were very based directly on that experience and the folks that I met there in Australia and everything. But then, you know, I just, it's funny how no matter... It's like a director or a writer's career, you know, always has sort of unexpected twists and turns. But I just kept having, you know, opportunities to work with wonderful actors from Japan in a lot of my films. And then the last movie that I made was a murder mystery set in San Francisco. But the main character is a Japanese murder mystery writer called Man from Reno. And that was, you know, that was the thing that sort of led directly to this opportunity to make House of Ninjas. So it started off with this coincidence and then became, you know, became something that was a passion of, you know, something that was, I feel it's a, you know, it's a constant source of interest. And I really like working there. There's a lot about it that I really, really love. So it all started with a coincidence. I'll just leave it at that.
Well, you know, it's a great origin story, and I really appreciate your time. I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking to us. The show is House of Ninjas. It's on Netflix. It's wonderful. Everyone should go out and see it. You should definitely try watching the first episode. Even just the trailer that they used to promote it on Netflix is brilliant. I think it's a wonderful moment in the show. Thanks so much for being here.
Thanks for having me. It's been a pleasure.
All right, so that was Dave Boyle. Dave, thank you so much for being on the show. What a great interview. I really enjoyed chatting. I hope you can come back on in the future. It'd be great.
I can't wait to see the show now.
Yeah, I really think it's your cup of tea. It's the type of thing you'd be into. So, Ben, guess what time it is?
Well, it's an hour different where you are than where I am, but I'm guessing in both places it is time to pay some bills.
Let's pay some bills. Hey, we got to thank the fine people over at Arri, makers of incredible cameras and lenses. I mean, when you think about cinema cameras, I mean, they don't make anything else. They're not a company that has like low-end products. They're not a company that has entry-level consumer DSLR type of mirrorless cameras. Arri does one thing. They do high-end cinema, and they do it really, really well. And by evidence, the Academy Awards from 48 hours ago, 3 of the 5 best cinematography nominees all shot on Arri cameras. And then 6 of the 10 best picture nominations were all shot with Arri cameras. So look, it is a ridiculous embarrassment of riches with Arri when it comes to cinema. And boy, do they knock it out of the park. There is a great article on the Arri website. And if you click on the homepage for Arri.com, it's the first thing up there. Just look for all the golden Oscar statues. It'll take you right to that article explaining, you know, all the people who have this past year working in the industry who were using Arri equipment to make fantastic movies.
Well, what more can you say?
And now, short ends.
So Ben, it is our short end time of the show.
What is your obsession this week?
Well, once again, I have to give credit to the algorithm at YouTube for figuring out what I would want to watch. You know, some people, it's about radicalizing them politically. For me, it's about delivering interesting filmmakers who are doing wacky stuff. And there's a channel called Slice of Life. And Slice of Life was the channel that these two guys set up for a short film they made that was like a Blade Runner. I don't know if I would call it a fan film. It's like a movie set in the Blade Runner universe. Anyway, it's two Croatian guys, Luka. I'm going to butcher their names. I apologize. Luka Hrgović and Dino Julius. And they co-direct and they do a ton of work with miniatures and compositing. And so it started showing me, YouTube started serving me up their videos, which I immediately subscribed to their channel. What I think they're doing is they're making like cool short films. They're not, I'm not saying that they're not creating content, but I don't feel like they are content creators first. I believe that they are filmmakers who are saying, hey, maybe we can get a following by doing a lot of in-depth, step-by-step vlogging about how we make our films. And their more current film is called Splashback, and it's a 1970s, 1960s period piece that takes place in great part at NASA. And these guys are using mostly gear that average people could get their hands on if they wanted to. Like, they're doing rear screen projection shots, and they're using, for the rear screen, they're using a consumer grade HD projector and getting pretty good results. And they show how they do like every step of it. Like, even with the miniatures, they show how they, like, they built the vehicle assembly building, and the guy basically narrates how he did it. He's using a 3D printer. He's using a laser cutter. You know, he's using some gear that's a little bit more on the pricey side. He builds the vehicle assembly building. He builds a rocket. He builds all these things. And then he shows how they shoot green screen of people and then comp them into shots. All the passes they do on miniatures. So they'll do like a beauty pass and a smoke pass and a lighting just the roof pass and all that stuff. And then they, in After Effects, they comp it all together and they kind of show step by step. And I feel like if I was a film student or even just someone very interested in doing my own indie stuff today, I think that they're a really cool resource to look at how they went about doing it. They show, like, in their miniatures, they use a lot of forced perspective. And, you know, like, even with the vehicle assembly building, they showed how they had, and they tell you the actual dimensions of it, but like the cars in the foreground were whatever percent the size of a real car, and then the middle ground, and then the background. And it's pretty informative stuff. And also, these guys are very relatable and funny, so it's not dry and boring. They're kind of sarcastic about what they do, although they take their work seriously. And I mean, they really show you, you know, there's one shot of it's like this massive, like, Raiders of the Lost Ark looking warehouse and these doors parting open and their actor walking in. And it's like they took a still frame of the actor and cut it out in cardboard and put it there for a shadow reference. But then they also had the green screen shot, and they showed how they made the shadows look more authentic in the miniature, because the warehouse was a miniature, and even like the chain hanging from the roof and the hook. And they show how they paint all the miniatures and all the little teeny tiny details that these guys are going into. And I was just super charmed by them and what they're doing and how much they're making with how little. Like, you look at the shots and you're like, wow, it's impressive looking stuff. And check them out. Slice of Life is their channel on YouTube, and that was also the name of their Blade Runner film, although their new film, like I said, is called Splashback.
That sounds super cool. I'll totally check that out. You know, Blade Runner type of stuff is my jam, so that's great.
Well, and Splashback is like kind of a campy period piece. Like, it's a little, like, I feel like they're doing stuff that miniatures make sense in. But yeah, the Blade Runner Slice of Life thing, like, they recreate sort of the cityscape of Blade Runner, and they, in my opinion, they really nail the look of it.
Yeah, that sounds super cool.
All right. So I can't imagine what your short end must be, because you've been like a week ago. I saw you in L.A. And since then, you've been to South by. You're doing all, you're moving, you're shaking. You have to wow me now. Bar is high.
Whoa, I don't know if I have something like that wowy for you. Wow.
Boom. Sorry. Take it away. So, bomb dropping. Boom. Go, will ya?
Okay. No. About a year ago, the U.S. government came up with an act they called the CCP Drones Act. And This was a potential bit of legislation that would ban Chinese-made drones. And you might be thinking, like, what do I care about Chinese-made drones? Well, it turns out, like, 80%+ of all the drones in this country are made in China.
Isn't DJI a Chinese company?
They sure are. DJI is a Chinese...
And they are, like, the every cinema drone I see is a DJI drone.
Correct. They're 80% of the market. So... A while ago, there was a bunch of claims made about DJI specifically, as well as just the ability for the Chinese government to have influence over drones that Americans may own already, or future drones that may be imported into this country. Well, DJI in the last week has decided to put a line-by-line counterpoint statement out saying that the assertions are false and that this is their truth. What will happen? I'm not sure, but I've heard that the drone business, which is 80% DJI, is a $116 billion business. It's wow. A massive, massive amount of money. I got to say, that would be a major sea change for DJI, and it would be a major sea change for people in the U.S. What's going to happen? Nobody knows, but DJI is not just going to essentially allow this to play out in Congress or allow this to play out via lobbyists. They're taking it to the people and they're putting their message out there. Now, I sell DJI products. They make products.
I was about to ask, yeah. Like, would that ding your business pretty hard?
I'm going to say no if that happened, because the number one product that we sell is not drones from DJI. We sell their Ronin gimbals way more. So unless those were affected too, then I don't think it would have too much effect on us. Yes, we do sell the occasional Inspire 3 or Mavic 3 or Mini 3. They seem to have a bunch of 3s right now. Actually, I think they're on 4 now for something. But regardless, we do sell those occasionally. And sure, it's nice to still have that source of income. But if the US government decided that we couldn't do it anymore, clearly we'd start to look for another drone manufacturer. Here's the thing. There are not that many other drone manufacturers out there.
I was going to ask, who's the number one US-based drone manufacturer?
People who make really, really expensive drones. I couldn't even tell you off the top of my head, but yes, there's a couple other Chinese drone manufacturers. There's a French drone manufacturer. And here's the thing, too. In our global world right now, even if you don't think you're buying products from China, there's a good chance there's a lot of the products that are being made in China. So there might be some sort of future system that, like, drone manufacturers maybe have to get components inspected, or they might have to get them certified, or they might have to do some sort of something. But yeah, I don't really know which way this is going to go. I know that Washington is a weird place, and there's sometimes a lot of threats about what could be that never end up happening. I don't know if this is going to be one of them, or I don't know if this is going to, like, it took another step towards getting closer to reality last month. We'll see what's going to happen. We'll put a link to the controversy and the DJI response in the show notes over at Cam Noir. And so anyone who wants to go down that rabbit hole is certainly welcome to. People who are drone operators are naturally nervous, because some of them, too, their livelihood depends on the maybe as much as like $20,000 they've invested in DJI drone now potentially being grounded, not being able to use that for their livelihood. It's interesting.
That's kind of bullshit. That's like, isn't that kind of an ex post facto law? Can you say that the drones that are currently working can't work anymore?
Well, I think what they're going to try and do is they would probably come up with some sort of like crippling firmware or something that says it can't interact with American telecommunication systems. And even then, I'm not sure exactly what would happen. But I will tell you, my local community college, I saw them very proudly stating that, hey, we've got to, you know, learn aerial cinematography, learn to fly a drone. It's a 3-unit course. You can sign up and take it. And I assure you.
Signed up. I would love to take that class.
Fun. I was actually really thinking about it. But it's like,
you know. I've been thinking, like, combine a drone with the Apple Vision Pro, and you're really onto something here.
I've never done the Apple Vision Pro, and I still remain skeptical. So I'm not gonna.
I actually watched a YouTube video about someone who hooked an Apple Vision Pro to their drone, and it becomes a more intuitive thing because it's like you're flying.
What about when you're driving?
There are people who are using them when they're driving.
I have
a pitch though. Kodak should put quadcopters on their $5,000 Super 8 camera. No one has ever done Super 8 drone footage. That would be a first.
No, that's not true. There is Super 8 drone footage. Absolutely. Yeah,
there is.
Yeah, but yeah, it goes back a ways. But yeah, people have been putting film cameras on drones for quite a while.
But
now,
Super 8?
Pretty sure. Yeah, I can't remember it off the top of my head. I know 16. I know 35. But
oh, I know 16 and 35. But like, have
we
ever had?
It's a lot easier to lift a Super 8.
Have we ever had a self-flying Super 8 camera for $5,000 or for any amount of money?
I got you one slightly better. I knew someone who engineered a giant styrofoam glider and threw it off a mountaintop and had their Super 8 camera attached to it. And that was back in like 1992 or 93. And it was an awesome video. It lasted like 3.5 minutes of this like glide time. But yeah, that's not a new thing.
Actually, total digression, but it reminds me, there was this filmmaker named Ralph Gibbs who had a couple of shorts that were noteworthy at Sundance and then kind of vanished off the face of the earth. But he made a movie called G that was literally just, he figured out a way to put, I want to say it was a 16 millimeter camera into some kind of device and threw it out of an airplane. And you just watched the whole falling down.
Oh, I saw that. Yeah, I saw that.
Yeah. Played Sundance. I don't know that it would get as much recognition these days.
If I recall correctly, I don't know if I saw that one, but I saw someone else throw a camera out of a plane, and it was a lot of like tumbling, and then it kind of got right for a bit.
No, he like engineered it, and he actually made a documentary that was interesting about how they figured out how to engineer the thing to put the camera in to drop it out of the airplane and make it fall. Like it was a pretty steady shot, but it was
Well, yeah, maybe I didn't see that one, because the one I saw was
somebody would be like, oh, so you flew your drone up really high and then you just went as fast down to the ground as you possibly could, possibly destroying your drone.
And then you sped up it in post too. So yeah, it looked really fast. Yeah. All right. Well, Ben, that just about does it for this show. Where can people find you if they want to track you down?
Track me down at benrock.com. I just paid for another year of that domain. Woohoo. You can see my current reel, social media stuff. You can find me on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Not TikTok yet. I feel like the day's coming. I'm going to probably end up on TikTok one day. How about yourself, Ilya? Where can people find you?
You can find me at Hot Red Cameras, hotredcameras.com. Also over at LinkedIn. I keep getting people reaching out to me on LinkedIn. So yeah,
I'm there too.
Yeah. All right. Cool. Yeah. You can hit me on LinkedIn Messenger, which is probably the worst messaging system ever. It's really terrible.
It is the pits. Like even like when you hit return, it doesn't send it. You're like, oh, I have to click. I have to pick up my hand and mouse over it. Oh,
I would so much rather have someone call me than LinkedIn Messenger. In fact, I'd rather have someone send me a snail mail letter. Send me a letter than the LinkedIn Messenger. LinkedIn Messenger is not the greatest, but it seems to be a really good connecting point for people. And then I go like, hey, what's your email? Or hey, what's your other thing? And then we connect that
way. Yeah. Excellent. Excellent. Well, Ilya, before we go, who do we have to thank this week?
Oh, hey, let's thank Ben Katz. Ben Katz, who edits these shows together, make sure we don't get too long-winded and run our mouths at whatever it is, keeps it moving so people are interesting. That's Ben's job. Ben does a great job at it. Let's thank Kay Zalatrachi. He composed the music for this episode. He's composed new music for future episodes. He is composing and composing. That guy is a composer. When he's not doing all the other things that he does, you can go to musicbykays.com to reach out to him. Reach out to him. You know, he also filled in for me and hosted the show. So that was great. Thank you, Kays.
Didn't he do a great job? I thought he did a great job.
He did. He really did splendid at that. Maybe he'll have to do it again now. So yeah. He didn't realize what he was committing to. He did it once. Now he's got to keep coming back.
I thought I was out.
We're pulling him back in. Hey, and we also, of course, have to thank Alana Cody. Alana Cody, who is making all these things happen, including over here at South By, so that we get new and interesting voices and opinions and people on the podcast talking about cinematography, talking about the art, craft, and philosophy and business of production. Yeah. And holy crap, there's going to be a lot to talk about this year. I'm not going to spoil it now, but there's a lot of business discussions happening. So we're gonna be getting into stuff in the coming weeks.
Alana is the best. We do not deserve her. She's awesome.
I deserve her a little bit. Just anyway. Okay. So Ben, you want to take us out?
Thanks for tuning in. Is that what we're still doing?
I got a new one. I'll propose to you.
I'll go for it.
I feel like we could say something like, until next time.
There you go. Why don't you take us out then? You got that one.
Until next time. I don't know exactly how to do it. I'll keep working on it. It's a work in progress, but
it's a work in progress.
I feel like there's something there.
This is the end of the show. Bye. Okay.
All right, I'm gonna awkwardly hit stop now. I'm gonna.
All right.
This has been the Cinematography Podcast, presented by Hot Rod Cameras. Find your next camera, lens, or accessory on the web at hotrodcameras.com. Don't forget to subscribe to our show on iTunes and connect with us on Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.